who is our speaker and award recipient for this evening's talk. Dr. Libby is the chief of cardiovascular medicine at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He received his MD from the University of California, San Diego, internal medicine and cardiology training at the then Peter Bent Brigham Hospital, work up through the academic ranks between there and Tufts University, became associate professor of medicine and then professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and in 1998 became the Mallinckrodt Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has numerous accomplishments, far too numerous to mention in my introductory remarks, but some of the notable ones that I wanted to mention tonight: he's been the editor-in-chief of Brunwald's Heart Disease, president of the Association of University Cardiologists, and he's been invited to deliver over 50 named or keynote lectures throughout the world. So if that number is true, then this is make 51. I'm sure it's far more than that now. He's a recipient of numerous grants and awards, including a prestigious merit award from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Memberships are many, included among them the Association of American Physicians, the American Society for Clinical Investigation, and honorary membership in the British Atherosclerosis Society. He's been editors of numerous journals and advisory boards. Importantly for our discussion tonight, he's been on the editorial board of Circulation and was an associate editor for many years in the journal that Carl Wegers founded, Circulation Research. He's the author of over 600 articles, reviews, chapters, and books. And he's made major contributions to understanding mechanisms of atherosclerosis and particularly inflammation underlying these mechanisms. And with that, as an introduction, I'd like to welcome Peter Libby to our Wiggers Award lecture.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. I think that you've already been acquainted with Dr. Wiggers and the Wiggers diagram, and it's the cornerstone of physiology. It's something that we all have become familiar with through the years. But you know, some of physiology's advance, Sugen Sagawa came up with the pressure volume loops, and that's also very important to add to what Carl Wiggers devised with his sort of two-dimensional view of ventricular function. But I want to give you my personal connection to one of his really enduring findings. This is the cover of my MD thesis, which was presented in March of 1973, before many of the fellows were born. And this was actually crafted with an ancient machine known as a typewriter, as you can see here. And if you go in my thesis to reference 43, you'll see that I was reading the then modern literature. And this is a thesis where we had really discovered that you might be able to do something to reverse infarction, which was a revolutionary idea at the time. It was thought that myocardial infarction was like a light switch, that it happened. It was a thunderbolt that came, and that it was inevitable necrosis. And I had the privilege of working with Dr. Brunwald, who was my thesis supervisor, who went contrarian to that notion. And what that Tennant and Wiggers paper showed was actually the first description of paradoxical ventricular motion during acute coronary ischemia. And I would say that there was a frothy head, but not too much in this. And I think, you know, the English, even in this one little paragraph, which I can't read from here because of the angle, you can see that he was elegant and precise in his language. He used a few $10 words as well as $5 words. And the finding that he made, and that is that there's paradoxical motion of the ischemic myocardium, is something that is of enduring significance that we remark every day in our clinical practices. So now what I'd like to do is go to the subject, which is molecular mechanisms or new insights into the pathophysiology of the acute coronary syndrome. So I'd like to start out with a case presentation. The patient I saw a few months ago, we'll call him Jogger Joe. He was a 61-year-old guy who presented with epigastric pain. He was really quite a health nut. He was very healthy, fit, not overweight, active, and he ran 5 miles every other day, had none of the usual market basket of risk factors, and had had an episode of epigastric pain about 2 weeks before while he was running. And so he self-diagnosed that he had some gastrointestinal distress and got an over-the-counter proton pump inhibitor and thought nothing of it. On the day of his presentation, though, he had a similar episode and actually got nauseated and had some vomiting. And his wife, he confessed this to his wife, who said, "You better go to the doctor." So he presented at one of our suburban clinics with this electrocardiogram, which clearly showed some ST segment elevation in the infralateral leads, and he was sent to the Brigham, where I met him in the emergency ward. By the time he came to the Brigham, his electrocardiogram was much better looking. No current of injury. There are a few flipped T waves in 1 and 3, but those could be normal variants. But his biomarkers were positive. His story was sort of suspicious, so I told him we were going to head down to the cath lab, where his left coronary system looked fine, and his right coronary artery. Now, there are interventionalists in the room, and the interventionalists would call this 80% stenosis or 70% stenosis. To a general and preventive cardiologist like me, I would call this a 40% stenosis. Okay, but of course, this guy did have ACS and was quite appropriately stented with a nice modern drug-eluting stent with a beautiful angiographic result. He did very well, had the usual post-MI care, and was seen by the fellow I was working with, Dr. Rajan Sah, 6 weeks afterwards without symptoms. So it's a very instructive case, but it's very, very normal, right? You see bread and butter cases like this every day, so why am I acquainting you with Joe Jogger? Well, I'll show you why in just a moment, because he's an example that causes us to rethink our traditional view of the acute coronary syndromes, in particular, the transition from chronic stable or asymptomatic atherosclerosis to the acute manifestations of this disease, which, of course, in the coronary circulation are unstable angina or acute myocardial infarction. But now in cardiology, we're branching out a bit and believe that we should let our catheters wander north and south of the heart as well. The concept here was that there is a accumulation of this grumous cholesterol debris on the pipe, and that the stenosis becomes so critical at a certain point that just a couple of platelets come and plug that lumen and lead to that transition. And if that's true, then how is it that this guy had a non-critically stenosed right coronary artery but had an ST segment elevation myocardial infarction? Well, that's because our traditional view, that plumber's view of the pathogenesis of the acute coronary syndromes, really doesn't fit the clinical data that we've acquired over the last 15 or 20 years. And the kinds of evidence I think you're familiar with, and I'm just going to hit the top lines of a few of the data sets. There were the results of the studies where angiography was performed post-thrombolysis. There were serial angiographic studies. And then there's the use of intravascular ultrasound, something familiar to everyone in this city. Well, let's take a look at one of the early studies that cast some doubt on our traditional notions of the pathogenesis of the acute coronary syndromes. So it's 1988, and the GCSE trial has just been published, where you can give streptokinase, and lo and behold, you improve outcome in individuals who had an acute anterior myocardial infarction. And in cardiovascular departments all over the world, people were beginning to squirt thrombolytics into coronary arteries and taking the patient to the cath lab and doing an angiogram. This was sort of the era of strep and stretch, for those who remember it. And Professor Attilio Masri, who was then still at the Hammersmith Hospital in London, studied 60 patients with quantitative coronary arteriography, or QCA, during their first myocardial infarction, but after lysis. And the surprising result was that when they got the lytic therapy, the underlying lesion was non-critically stenotic in about half of the patients. This was an extraordinarily vexing finding and one that was actually difficult to publish. Those of you who know Attilio Masri will know that he doesn't give up easily, and he managed to get it published. If you talk to Bill Little, who is the author of one of the four studies that is summarized here, This particular diagram from Sid Smith's compilation pools the data from four different studies from three countries and two continents, and the data are really highly concordant, be they contrarian. And in these studies, what the investigators did was they took a look at the angiogram that happened to have been recorded in the weeks to months preceding the index myocardial infarction and said, what did today's culprit look like on the antecedent angiogram? And the surprising finding, and Bill Little will tell you, it was really hard to publish. He had to wait for the editor of circulation to change to get this published, that in only about 15% of cases was the stenosis at the site of today's myocardial infarction critically stenosed, or one that was even hemodynamically significant on the antecedent angiogram. Fully two-thirds of acute myocardial infarction are happening at places that on a prior angiogram that happened to have been recorded, we would have passed over as being a minor irregularity or an insignificant stenosis of less than 50%. You know, we call those minor irregularities insignificant lesions, but those insignificant lesions are causing the lion's share of acute myocardial infarction. And why is that? It's because this disease plays tricks on us. We can't think like plumbers. The artery remodels outward to incorporate the plaque as it grows until late in its life history. And we've learned a great deal from the application of intravascular ultrasound. We know that you can have a perfectly normal appearing coronary artery, but when you interrogate with ultrasound, which I don't have to explain to this audience, you can see that the normal angiogram can conceal a great burden of disease. And indeed, we know that that is the rule, not the exception. So there's more to the acute coronary syndromes, more than stenosis to atherosclerosis. Now, another reason that I found this particular case of Joe Jogger interesting was because he seems to have lysed between the time that he presented with the current of injury and the time that he came to our cath lab when he had TIMI 3 flow. And I guess the interventionalist can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but it looks pretty good to me, and the stenosis does not look critical. So why did this guy autolyze? And we have to give lytic or have to open up with a wire other patients. Well, I'd like to think that it's because he had a healthy lifestyle. And I like to think about this in terms of the two-state concept. Now, this is not my solution to the Middle East conflict. This is the concept, and I think some of you have heard this in other words from Valentin Fuster, where he talks about bad blood or vulnerable blood and the vulnerable plaque. So yes, the solid state of the plaque is very important, but also there's what happens in the fluid phase, okay, the blood. And I would say that people who are trim and who are physically active are going to have lower levels of plasminogen activator inhibitor to put a brake on their endogenous thrombolytics, because you remember that there is urokinase-type plasminogen activator and tissue-type plasminogen activator associated with the endothelial cells and many of the other cells that we find in the body. And if we have low levels of this endogenous inhibitor, then we have more chance of being able to autolyze our clots. By the same token, fibrinogen is an acute phase reactant that goes up in patients with obesity and those with glucose intolerance and those with inflammation. And so I would say that Joe Jogger probably had a fibrinolytic system that was doing push-ups and had low levels of fibrinogen, so he was able to lyse his own clot before he got our mechanical assistance in the cath lab. So if it isn't a progression of the grumous cholesterol debris accreting on the artery wall until we get this pinpoint widowmaker narrowing, what is it that causes the transition to the acute thrombotic complications of atherosclerosis? Well, the pathologists have actually known this for generations, but it's only been recently that we in cardiovascular medicine have embraced the concept that the trigger for most thrombi is a physical disruption of the atherosclerotic plaque. By far and away, the most common cause is this rupture of the fibrous cap, accounting for somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of acute fatal myocardial infarction. The late Prof. Michael Davies really one of those 50 lectures was the inaugural Mike Davies lecture. He was a great friend of mine and a great teacher of mine. And this is one of his remarkable preparations of one of these plaques that ruptured, as you can see right here, where the arrows are, and allowed the blood contact with material in the plaque's lipid core, and that set off the thrombus that killed this patient. And you'll notice that in this case, the fibrous cap is very, very thin and friable, and that's why it ruptured and caused the death of the patient. And Mike Davies and others were able to define, by careful morphometric quantitative studies, the microanatomical characteristics of the so-called vulnerable plaque, plaques that cause fatal acute MI. They have large lipid pools. They're rich in inflammatory cells, macrophages. They have thin fibrous caps. And although we actually chased after smooth muscle proliferation as a therapeutic target for many years, in this room we had the restenosis summit 12 years ago or so, and everyone was trying to stamp out smooth muscle proliferation. The places where plaques rupture are actually more recognizable for the paucity of smooth muscle cells rather than their abundance. Well, here's another view of a disrupted plaque from one of my collaborators, Lourdes Gucci in São Paulo. And it makes the point here that we have a perfectly decent caliber vessel. This might have looked normal or quasi-normal on an angiogram, yet there's the clot that killed the patient, and it happened because of the fracture of the plaque's fibrous cap. So my laboratory had been studying the role of inflammation in vascular biology as all of this challenge to our traditional notion of the pathogenesis of acute coronary syndromes was a brew. And we set ourselves the task about 12 or 15 years ago to ask the question, could it be that inflammation is related to this acute coronary syndrome situation? And so how do we go about approaching that in the laboratory, taking all these clinical data which were coming to light and having it guide our experiments in the basic research laboratory? Well, what we decided to do was to study the metabolism of the collagen that makes up the fibrous cap, because actually that's what fails in the disrupted plaque. We were able to find out by very simple reading that the biomechanical integrity of the plaque's fibrous cap depends on interstitial collagen fibrils that are synthesized in the artery by smooth muscle cells. There's your collagen fibril with its typical banding. And this is the same collagen that gives strength to your skin, that allows me to stand here because it gives strength to the bones and the sinew of the body. That's what is keeping that fibrous cap intact in the atherosclerotic plaque. So now we could go back to the laboratory with a focused hypothesis that was testable. Could it be that these inflammatory mediators or growth factors, which were very fashionable to study in the 1980s, could they influence the synthesis of new collagen by smooth muscle cells? So this is an oldie but goodie experiment, and let me remind you that collagen synthesis is very complex. It's not just the usual transcription and translation like every protein, but there's a lot of post-translational processing. There's hydroxylation, there's cross-linking, there's proteolytic processing, there's self-assembly into these triple helices, and the triple helices will self-assemble into these large cables or fibers. And one of the interesting features of the collagen molecule is that it's pretty monotonous in its protein sequence, amino acid sequence, during much of the stretch of the mature collagen molecule. Indeed, 2 out of 3 of the amino acid residues in the collagen, interstitial collagen chain are derived from proline or proline, or our proline. So it's proline hydroxyproline. So by the simple expedient of feeding smooth muscle cells in the laboratory some radioactively labeled proline, we were able to get an arm around collagen synthesis by these cells. And this is a venerable experiment where we asked smooth muscle cells to incorporate radioactively labeled proline and separated the supernatant medium that contained the proteins that were synthesized by these cells by gel electrophoresis, and then just took the electrophoretogram and put on X-ray film. So where there's radioactivity, it made bands. The darker the bands, the more radioactivity. And what you can see here is in the basal state, this smooth muscle cell, as a good vascular smooth muscle cell should do, was incorporating proline into newly synthesized collagen. When we expose the smooth muscle cells to mediators that are derived from platelets when they degranulate, such as transforming growth factor beta, shown here, or platelet-derived growth factor, shown here, the bands are darker, indicating an increased rate of collagen synthesis. That's very important in plaque healing, which I won't have time to go into tonight. But what was really fascinating and provocative to us when we got these results was what's shown in the last lane of this experiment. When we took human smooth muscle cells, vascular smooth muscle cells, and incubated them with immune interferon, gamma interferon, which we and others had localized and showed was active in the atherosclerotic plaque, we virtually shut down new collagen synthesis. And even when we stimulated the smooth muscle cells maximally with transforming growth factor beta, TGF-beta, to ratchet up the collagen synthesis to floor the accelerator on collagen synthesis, we were able to bring rates of collagen synthesis down to baseline or below by co-incubation with immune interferon. So this was a very important finding for us because it suggested that perhaps when we have inflammation in the intima, that there is a defect in the repair mechanism, which ordinarily fixes the fibrous cap and keeps it strong and able to withstand the stresses of the circulation. But of course, the concentration of any macromolecule, collagen included, depends not only on its rate of synthesis, but also on its rate of breakdown. So the next step was to reason that perhaps there's a defect in the breakdown or catabolism of collagen. And we know that the triple helical collagen molecule is really very resistant to breakdown. As a matter of fact, there are only a handful of proteinases in the human body that can make the initial proteolytic attack on the triple helical collagen fibril and break it into its classical three-quarter and one-quarter fragments that are the initial products of the collagen catabolic pathway. You will note that when this happens, when collagenases, interstitial collagenases that are members of the matrix metalloproteinase or MMP family, make this cleavage at this canonical cleavage site, that they uncover a new carboxyl terminus, and that can be recognized with an antibody and make a neoepitope. Okay. So we can actually track collagen breakdown in situ with an antibody that recognizes this neoepitope that's the signature of collagen breakdown in situ. And with my associate, Dr. Galina Sukova, we were able indeed to localize in green fluorescence here this signature, this fingerprint of collagen that's partially broken down in the tender, vulnerable shoulder region of atherosclerotic plaques where they often fail. This is the lumen. The lipid core would be around here. There's the shoulder region right here. And surrounds an area of intact collagen that's stained orange and co-localizes, as we had previously shown, with macrophages that are overexpressing two flavors of this interstitial collagenase family, MMP1 and MMP13. In other studies that I don't have time to go into, for strange reasons, we found a third flavor of interstitial collagenase known as MMP8 in the atherosclerotic plaque and not expressed by neutrophils, which is the supposed source of neutrophil collagenase and collagenase 3, but by endothelial cells, smooth muscle cells, and macrophages in the human atherosclerotic plaque. So there seems to be a conspiracy of collagenases that are increased in the inflamed atherosclerotic plaque and that can attack the collagen that lends strength to the plaque's fibrous cap. So back a dozen years ago, I had the courage to publish this cartoon on the basis of observational data that told a story that when we have inflammation in the intima, the T cell with the blue nucleus sends signals to the smooth muscle cell in red there, and through gamma interferon signaling, turns down collagen synthesis. The T cell can also send signals, which we worked out in the laboratory, to the macrophage to tell it to ratchet up its synthesis of these collagenolytic enzymes that can break down that collagen and jeopardize the integrity of the plaque's fibrous cap. So when we have inflammation, it puts the collagen fibril in double jeopardy. Decreased synthesis, increased breakdown, and that sets the stage for the acute coronary syndromes. So that was a very nice cartoon, widely reproduced, and got me a grant or two. But, you know, we didn't have any direct evidence that this actually held water. And so over the last 10 years or so, we've devoted a lot of effort to trying to pin down this hypothesis and prove it experimentally. And the way that we have approached that is, as many other laboratories, using genetically modified mice, not because they're models of human atherosclerosis, but because we can test hypotheses very conveniently and very cleanly, because we can do all of the genetic and dietary manipulations. And the first way that we approached this was to work with a mouse that had a mutation introduced into it that eliminated that canonical cleavage site, where this very important isoleucine P1 residue at the cleavage site was mutated to a proline in a knock-in to the endogenous collagen or procollagen gene site. And as you recall, those of you who recall your biochemistry, proline puts a little twist. It's an amino acid, not an amino acid. It puts a little twist in the protein chain, the polypeptide backbone, and makes this a non-substrate for the metalloproteinases. So the metalloproteinases cannot break this down. So what we did was to take that knock-in mutant mouse that had collagenase-resistant collagen and crossbreed it with one of these mice that has an engineered defect that makes it susceptible to diet-induced atherosclerosis. And this part of the experiment takes about 2 years, okay, to get the mice on a congenic background. You have to go through 7 back crosses, do a lot of genotyping and all. And I have some very courageous postdocs who did that. And then you do the experiment, which takes a matter of months, where you feed these animals Western diet, somewhat akin to what some of you had here at the Ritz-Carlton tonight. The Western diet also bears a striking resemblance in its caloric and nutrient value to the lunches which are provided for our cardiology fellows very often. And then at the end of this experimental period, we analyze the atheroma. Now, the phenotypes of these mice I'm going to show you are really complex, and the ones I'm going to show you have been published, so you can read about them in detail if you want to know. But I'm going to give you just the top-line results. It's after dinner, after all, and you deserve a break. So this is a section through the aortic root of one of these animals. This is the one that has the wild-type collagen, or the collagenase-sensitive collagen. You recognize the sinuses of Valsalva, and you can see in this animal that there's atheromatous accretion here in the sinuses of Valsalva. This is the intima, media, adventitia, intima, media, adventitia there. And we've stained with a really pretty stain called picrocereus red. It's a dye that aligns when there are those collagen fibrils, and it will twist light, and under polarization optics, it gives this bright orange birefringence. And you can see that there's interstitial collagen, a fair amount of it in this plaque, some in this plaque, and not too much in this plaque here. Now let's look at an animal that's genetically identical except for that one amino acid change. Okay? That's what those 7 back crosses are for, to make sure that we have no other alterations. On the same diet, and you see that there's much more collagen. We now have confluent collagen in the plaques in all 3 sinuses of Valsalva. Now, this bright orange birefringence makes it great for quantitation with a computer because we can threshold really well with our computer-assisted quantitative image analysis. And no matter how we sliced it or diced it, the orange bars from the collagenase-resistant mice show greater accumulation of collagen than the animals that had the wild-type collagen shown in these yellow bars. So this is really very comforting to us that that cartoon that we published in 1995 actually held water, because it showed in genetically altered mice direct evidence that linked collagenolysis with the control of collagen content. But of course, that doesn't answer the question, which protease is responsible? Now let me say right from the get-go that what's true in the mouse is not going to be true in humans, because the mice used a different palette of proteinases than humans. But again, we're testing hypotheses. We're probing for principles here. We're not trying to say that the mouse is a human. Okay? And there are a variety of these different proteinases. I introduced you to three, and then there's another one called MT1 MMP or MMP14 that some people think can be either direct or indirect collagenase. So we want now to do the converse experiment and mutate one of the proteinases. And we chose to mutate what is the mouse's favorite interstitial collagenase, or one of their favorite interstitial collagenases, MMP13. And we did a very similar kind of experiment where we took the mutant mouse and put it on the atherosclerotic background and fed it the atherogenic diet and a similar kind of phenotyping. And once again, let's just focus here first on the picrocereus red staining. This is the intimal lesion, and you see in the intimal lesion that there's more accumulation of collagen in the collagenase defective animal. Okay? And when we quantitate it again, certainly at the latter time point here, as shown by the yellow bar compared to the gray bar, that there is a greater accumulation of collagen in the plaques in the animals that lack just one of these several matrix metalloproteinases that can contribute to the catabolism or breakdown of collagen. So now we really thought that we had some experimental evidence that collagenases can critically influence collagen accumulation in the mouse atheroma in vivo. And we, of course, are going down the list, and actually a lot of these experiments are done or are in progress where we've lined up the mutants in the different mice, and I won't bore you with the results. We do have some of these results already, but basically they don't challenge the principle. The results of the studies don't challenge the principle that I've enunciated here. Now, one thing that may be occurring to you, say, this is very nice. Peter likes to play with mice, and the NIH gives him money to play with mice. But we take care of patients, and how can we take this wonderful biology, this great science, and apply it to people? And I'll tell you that, I practice cardiology, and I'm a cardiologist, too, and I want to see it applied to people, too. So we're spending a great deal of time now trying to work out a field called molecular imaging, where we're taking some of the biology that we've worked on in the laboratory and transferring it into patients. You know, all of our imaging in cardiology, with the exception of a couple of PET techniques, is based on structure or anatomy rather than function. And we have so much functional knowledge that's accumulating now that wouldn't it be neat if we could image it? So to do that, I've linked up with a brilliant chemist and radiologist at the Center for Molecular Imaging at our partner institution, the Mass General, Dr. Ralph Weislader. And Ralph, molecular imaging is sort of standard stuff in cancer, but it hasn't been exploited much in the cardiovascular arena. And I'm working with Ralph on trying to bring molecular imaging into cardiology. And one of the obvious targets would be these proteinases, because you can make beacons that are molecular reporters of proteolytic activity that work by having, say, a quenched fluorescent substrate that when the proteases can cleave it, will all of a sudden release these quenched fluorophores from their quenching, and they become brightly fluorescent. They increase their fluorescence by several hundred fold. Okay? And you can detect them with a near-infrared optics. Now, we've begun to explore this, again, in the experimental preparation here in mice. The first of our forays into this was published in Circulation recently, where we were able to visualize matrix metalloproteinase action in macrophages in vivo in the mouse and can actually look at inflammation, which, if you think about it, is a pretty neat thing. It might actually be a tool to help us gauge what drugs are working on what targets in ways that will allow us to do studies in 100 or 200 patients over 6 months or a year before we go into the big clinical trial and pull the trigger. We were talking at dinner about how at the college meeting this year there seemed to be a number of negative trials, but if you run before you walk, you're going to fall sometimes. And if we could actually understand the biology that we're affecting with our drugs, maybe we could pick the ones to go into clinical trials a little more intelligently going forward. But let me just show you some science fiction here. This is nowhere ready for prime time, but we're working, for example, on ways to visualize MMP13 that could work with humans in catheter-based technologies that I'll talk about in just a second. Let me just show you in the mouse how we validated this MMP13 probe, because we have the MMP13 mouse, which is a perfect control. So here we're looking in the upper row at some light images, white light images, and then the near-infrared fluorescent images in the bottom. And you see this is a negative control here, no signal when we don't add the probe. And when we add the probe, we see very nice fluorescent signal. And if we add the probe to a mouse that's exactly the same except one mutation in MMP13, same diet, same amount of time, same gender, everything, that you see that there's much less activity. And the little inset here shows you that the MMP13 deficient mouse indeed lacks MMP13 that can be detected by monoclonal antibody stain. So we're really excited that we're going to be able to apply a combination of chemistry and optics to measure protease activity or inflammation that's important in the biology of the plaque in vivo. Now, we can't do it by external imaging in humans. We could possibly do it with a carotid of the iliac. Certainly couldn't do it with the coronaries because of issues of penetration and motion. And that's why Farouk Jaffer and others in Ralph's group are working with us to develop catheter-based ways in which we'll be able to measure these infrared fluorescent signals. And when I said it's science fiction, I want to take you on a fantastic voyage down the aorta of a Watanabe rabbit. Watanabe rabbits are like familial hypercholesterolemic rabbits. They develop atherosclerosis because of a genetic tendency, a defect in the LDL receptor. And this rabbit has been fed a substrate which reports on a protease, not a metalloproteinase, not a protease which we're sure is important in atherosclerosis, but this is proof of principle. So we're going to take a walk down this aorta. It's one of these catheters that has coaxial white light and fiber optics for measuring the near-infrared fluorescence. Okay? And the white light shows us the atheromata, and coded pseudocolor, where the warm colors, like you're seeing there in red, indicate protease activity. Here we're actually visualizing protease activity in situ in an atherosclerotic artery in the rabbit by using molecular imaging. And we're expending a great deal of effort to try to make this clinically applicable in the coming years. Okay, so I've told you that proteinases participate in the pathogenesis of the acute coronary syndromes and that we are working with toys to try and make it applicable clinically. But there's part of the story that I have sort of swept under the rug, and that is, why does it matter if you have a crack in the plaque's fibrous cap if you don't have thrombosis? So what is it that makes it so dangerous for the blood to gain access to this compartment, the core of the plaque? I've told you about the economy of collagen that weakens the fibrous cap and what we understand about the molecular pathogenesis of the defect that weakens the cap. But what about the thrombogenicity of the lipid core? What makes it so dangerous for the blood to touch that stuff? Well, actually, that's been known for a number of years, and work up from my laboratory showed that it was tissue factor, procoagulant, in a population of macrophages in the plaque's core that is critical in triggering the thrombus. The mystery was, what turns on the tissue factor? The usual soluble cytokines that we and others had localized in the plaque are very wimpy inducers of tissue factor in human monocyte macrophages. And a few years ago, François Mach and Uwe Schoenbeck, where they were fellows in my group, were able to identify the signal that we think is turning on tissue factor in these macrophages. And it's an inflammatory signaling dyad, CD40 ligand, and its receptor CD40. The analytical data report in this paper, but this pretty picture just shows you that that receptor, CD40 in green, is on the very same cells that are overexpressing tissue factor in the plaque. So we believe that inflammation is not only critical in governing the stability of the fibrous cap, but also in regulating the thrombogenicity of the core. Okay? So we're really entering an era of the new biology of atherosclerosis. We understand that unstable coronary atheromata are not always the tight stenosis, and that gives us a new therapeutic goal, and that is stabilization of lesions by medical therapy that is something beyond revascularization that may have an enduring benefit for our patients. So how do we go about stabilizing atherosclerotic plaques? Well, there are things that no one wants to hear about. You know, smoking cessation, diet, physical activity, and genetics are important as well. So I would exhort you all to choose your parents wisely. Okay. But often these are very difficult goals for our patients, or even when very compulsively applied, if you have the non-modifiable risk factors, such as genetics that you can't control, that are out of whack, they're not enough to lower the risk of our patients. And that's why it's great that we have tools that actually do seem to lower cardiovascular events. Lipid lowering, by every method that's been tested, can improve outcomes. Now, this straight line is a little bit of a lie because there are different time scales that are involved in another dimension of this graph, but I'm showing it to summarize data that shows that whether you use ileal bypass or cholestyramine or statins, that if you lower LDL, you're going to improve events. Now, I want to conclude by sort of wrapping that victory of clinical science into the basic science that I've been talking about, pathophysiology, and try to give you my answer to this question: is how is lipid lowering improving patient outcome? Well, the first guess of any of us who were brought up in the era of angiography would be we're regressing the fixed stenoses. In other words, we're turning back the clock on that grommets material that is lining the plaques. Or for the interventional cardiologist in the audience, this would be the before picture, and this is the after picture. Okay? Is that the way that lipid lowering is improving outcomes in our patients? We have about 14 angiographically monitored studies that tested that hypothesis with coronary arteriography, quantitative coronary arteriography, that could measure the fixed stenoses to a tolerance of tens of microns. And indeed, when you take lipid lowering, and again, it doesn't matter what the pathway is, it could be even diet, if you have those electronic calipers and you go and measure very carefully and you do hundreds of plaques, you can eke out a few percent improvement in the diameter of the fixed stenoses. You can get a p-value of less than 0.05, and you can publish in the New England Journal, and you can get promoted, okay? But let me ask you practically, does it make much difference if we improve the diameter of the fixed lesions by a percent, by a few red cell diameters? Okay. Even to the fourth power of radius, I think that's a stretch. But even in these underpowered for events, angiographic studies, there was a huge disconnect between the clinical benefit, which was robust, and the modest and perhaps disappointing improvement in the fixed luminal stenoses. Greg Brown pointed this out, and that's why I've selected his study, which was the FATS trial, which really he's the one who was responsible for pointing out this disconnect, this paradox. Well, what does it mean? It means that we've got to get smarter than just thinking about stenosis. We've been worshiping at the altar of stenosis, and we need to think more like biologists in addition to being plumbers and think about the quality of the lesion, not just its quantity or the amount of encroachment on the lumen. So we can reject this hypothesis, the regression of fixed stenoses, based on the concordant dozen or more trials with coronary arteriography. And what I'd like to finish with is by telling you that I think that lipid lowering is, at least in part, an anti-inflammatory intervention, so we can reject the regression model. Now, that's sort of hard to get at in humans, but we backed into it using one of the most reliable preparations in all of experimental pathology, the cholesterol-fed rabbit. And again, this is an experiment that required a great deal of patience. I had to convince a fellow to take on a project that was guaranteed to give no publication for at least 2 years. And what he did, Dr. Aikawa, when he was a fellow, he's now a faculty member, was to create lesions by a period of cholesterol feeding after a balloon injury to make fibrofatty lesions that resembled more the human lesion than the usual typical fatty streak, which we see in rabbits. I'll show you what the baseline lesions look like in just a moment. And some animals were kept on a high cholesterol diet, and others were shifted to a low cholesterol diet. You'll notice there's no magic here, no statin, no pixie dust. This is just a lifestyle intervention in the rabbit. Pretty severe one, but we can't put our patients in a cage and control their diets the way that we can do in the laboratory. So here's what the baseline lesions look like, and you'll notice there's a fibrous cap made up of smooth muscle cells that are bearing alpha actin. There's a lipid core here that stains robustly for macrophages. There's the internal elastic lamina. There are smooth muscle cells in the media there. And the macrophages in the rabbit, just like the macrophages in the human plaque, are overexpressing collagenase 1 or MMP1. And this is an immunostain for bunny MMP1. Okay. Now let's look at what happened when we went 16 months later on the animals that had the persistently hypercholesterolemic diet. A lot of inflammation and a lot of collagenase indicating activation of those macrophages. If we look, however, at the animals that were shifted to the low cholesterol diet, you see there's a marked ebbing of the inflammatory cells, and it's really hard to see much collagenase in these animals that have been shifted to the low cholesterol diet. And if we look at the collagenous structure using that pretty orange stain, we see a fantastic reinforcement of the collagenous structure of the intima here. This is intima, media, adventitia, intima, media, adventitia. So we're actually making plaques that pathologists would tell us were hard plaques, that they were less likely to rupture and cause thrombosis. You can quantitate that, show the reciprocal relationship between the protease expression and the collagen content, Biochem 101. Now, the rabbits, just like the humans, have overexpression of tissue factor in their macrophages in the plaque, shown there by an immunostain. And when we step the animals down to a low cholesterol diet, lo and behold, the tissue factor goes away, at least in the intima. It persists in the adventitia, as you see here, which is where it's supposed to be. You and I have tissue factor in our adventitia for obvious reasons. Okay. So when we lower the lipids with a dietary intervention, we actually cause a great deal of benefit in terms of the inflammation and the structure of the plaque. Well, we've used everything in these rabbits but the fur and published a bunch of papers, and so I'm not going to bore you with all that, but to give you the bottom line here, is that lipid lowering appears to stabilize atheromata by limiting inflammation, by improving features of plaques that are associated with stability in humans, that reduce plaque thrombogenicity by decreasing the tissue factor, and decrease oxidative stress and endothelial dysfunction as monitored by endothelial nitric oxide synthase production. But of course, the rabbits are not people, and we're docs, and we want to know, does this apply to humans? Now, we can't, I told you, put the humans in the cage, and we can't chop up their aortas and stain them ad lib. So how do we get into that question? Well, we can use a biomarker of inflammation, high-sensitivity CRP. And one of the wonderful things about my environment is that we have doctors Bromwald and Pfeffer and Sachs who did the CARE trial, the second mega trial in the statin era, and Dr. Ridker, who'd been looking at validating C-reactive protein as a marker of inflammation. And they got together, and they said, well, let's test and see whether or not inflammation is decreased by statins. And that's the second bar here in this slide, the CARE trial. That's the index study that showed that statins can decrease inflammation as monitored by high-sensitivity CRP. And the reason I have this whole family of curves is to show it's not my statin, it's not your statin. It looks like all statins are decreasing the inflammation as gauged by C-reactive protein. And I think you've all heard some of the evidence that came out of the analyses of the PROVE IT trial, the reversal trial, now the A to Z trial, that show that if you do very careful analysis of the outcomes, looking at LDL lowering and looking at CRP lowering, that they appear not to be looking at the same thing. And indeed, the analysis of those clinical trials suggests that the statins are doing something beyond LDL lowering that's anti-inflammatory. So experimental and human studies suggest that lipid lowering may stabilize plaques and reduce events by limiting inflammation. So that led to the idea of the vulnerable plaque. And I think that's a very oversimplified perspective, but that's a different talk for another night. And I just want to leave you with a practical bottom line from all this biology and all the thinking I've done about this through the years. And that is that local therapies are great for relieving angina. And line me up. When I have lifestyle-limiting angina on maximum medical therapy, I want the best intervention for revascularization possible. But I wouldn't expect that to decrease myocardial infarction or prolong life. It is the systemic therapies, not the local therapies, that actually have achieved event reductions in broad categories of patients and very reproducibly. And you've all followed what's happened in the clinical trials over the last few months with the OAT trial, showing that the open artery hypothesis doesn't really hold up for people who have they're out of the acute phase or hyperacute phase of their myocardial infarction. Outcomes are the same if you get revascularized or not. We heard the COURAGE trial from Bill Bowden and colleagues. It was just published in the New England Journal that showed that in patients with stable coronary disease, that medical therapy looks pretty good in terms of events and outcomes compared to intervention. So the clinical bottom line of this new biology is that not that we should choose revascularization or medical therapy. We need the best of both. And when we're done with the intervention, we've only begun. That's the beginning. What we need to do is institute a lifestyle program and appropriate medical therapy is driven by guidelines to modify the biology of the underlying disease and prevent future events. So here's a heart with a lumpy, bumpy LAD, like those of us who are guys with gray hair probably already have, and we have a spectrum of lesions, bookends, one that causes stenosis and one that is eccentrically remodeled and is inapparent. The stenotic ones are fewer, and their characteristics we've been over. The non-stenotic ones are more likely to cause a rupture and acute thrombotic complication. The stenotic guys are, they're our familiar turf. The patients develop angina, we'll put them on a treadmill, their ST segments will sag, we'll put them in the nuclear camera and they'll have a perfusion defect. And so that's our standard fare in cardiology. But the challenge is achieving equal mastery over the non-stenotic plaques, which are often silent in the, until they cause a thrombotic complication such as a STEMI. And the management strategy needs to be the best of intervention for the local lesions and the best of systemic therapy, lifestyle modification, and drug therapy for those more numerous and very mischievous non-stenotic lesions. So I'm going to stop there and thank you very much for the honor and privilege of being here in the footsteps of my mentors and teachers through the year and honoring Dr. Wigger, whose thinking and work influenced even my first steps in the research laboratory. And thank you very much.
And managing to bridge terrific basic science with clinical science with a talk that truly represents the spirit of this award.